when a comedian will do an Asian accent. And I start watching carefully the Asian people in the audience, and they laugh. The white people get very, very nervous. Most people are not nuts. I mean, accents do exist, and imitating one is not a prima facie case of hatefulness. Social media was scaring the shit out of everybody. This was the enforcement mechanism, and it emboldened people. Wokeness on top of that is just a sick, disgusting ideology. I just always knew in my gut that I had to oppose that. Defending Louis, I was also striking a blow for the notion that the presumptions of innocence were important, meaning that if the customers wanted to see him and I wanted to present him, and there's a closed community here of people who want to see Louis C.K., who's not been convicted or even charged with any crime, that is not the business of the greater society. The ad hoc nature of the outrage and believing all women and all this stuff is just absurd at this point. Kamala Harris's husband was accused of doing much worse than anything Louis C.K. was ever accused of, and nobody cared. So my father had a Middle Eastern nightclub called the Cafe Finjan, which was where the cellar is now. And he moved it at some point to a bigger room next door, which left a kind of vacuum space that wasn't really being used. And we tried a few things there. But then a guy named Bill Grundfest, who you could Google, and he's still around. He later became head writer on Mad About You. And he and I still have a relationship. He actually came in and said, "Hey, Manny, why don't you do some comedy here? I'll bring comedians, you take the drinks, and I take the door," like that kind of thing. So it started out very like ad hoc and as an experiment, and it caught on pretty well right at the top. And then Bill continued to be the MC, and he ran it for, I don't know, 6-7 years, something like that. Then he left to make his fortune in Los Angeles, and my father took it over. And then my father died in 2003, and then I took it over. So that's that. And then, and how did it become so huge? I don't know. Very gradual overnight sensation, you know, like that cliche, gradually and then all of a sudden, or gradually and all at once, whatever that Hemingway thing is. That's kind of what it was. We spent many, many years just kind of successful, but not over the top. And then almost it seemed like overnight, it just took off like in the 2010, something like that.
And I'd love to get into that phase of the cellar, but I know I've heard you in research for this conversation talk about your dad. And I think I heard you say once that he was sort of a larger than life character.
Yeah.
And I'd love to give you some space to talk about him. And it's obvious in just the interviews I've watched in preparation for this conversation, how much he meant to you. Who was he, and who was he to you?
Well, my father was, you know, one of these generations of self-made men. He was born with enormous talent. He's born in 1930 in Israel. And came here in 1939, so he would have been 8 years old, I guess. And or maybe it was 1938 and he would have been seven. But because his birthday was at the last week of the year. He, because of the various headwinds there were being a young immigrant boy at that time, he grew up kind of thinking that he wasn't very bright. And his he was kind of the ne'er-do-well in the family, while his sister, who was awful, but she was the one identified as the one with the future. And he kind of just bounced around until he was 30 years old. He sold brushes. He was a taxi driver. He was a merchant seaman. He got fired from things. He, you know, all kinds of shit. Dropped out of high school, then went into the Air Force, then faked depression on the advice of a psychologist. My aunt's husband taught him exactly how to behave to get discharged because he was in Newfoundland doing nothing. And then he got into the Columbia and the GI Bill, dropped out of there. Anyway, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then he opened a little coffee shop in 1960. And from there became extremely successful. And at that point, I think, began to reassess his own abilities. By the time he was 40, he was I think, considered to be quite an important person, quite an intellect, and kind of a role model for many other people in all walks of life. And then when the Comedy Cellar started, he really took to the comedians, and then he started a whole new chapter as kind of a hero to the comedians. So that's it. And he was a single dad, and a very devoted father to me.
Hmm. Was comedy always a big part of his personality and his life, or did he sort of come to that as he took over the Cellar?
Well, he was a performer. He was a musician, and he was always very funny. And, you know, humor is such an integral part of Jewish culture, specifically the Jewish culture of that generation. Every point, every almost lesson that a father would impart to a son was illustrated with a joke. You know, there's a joke for every kind of truism of life. And he was very quick-witted. So, no, he wasn't particularly or in any way involved with comedians. But when he did finally interface with comedians, it was like a match made in heaven. It was a perfect match. They all thought he was every bit as funny as they were.
What was it about comedians, you think, that made him so attracted to them? Why was it a match made in heaven?
First of all, because they could all laugh together, but because comedians have a thick skin. They like to talk about things they're not allowed to talk about. They're not easily offended, although they can be offended, but they're less easily offended than most people. They're not moralistic. They have quirky individual personalities, which makes them interesting. And all these things went for my father as well. So I think that's why.
Do you know what his goals were? Like when he took over this, you know, this comedy venue, which I assume at that time very few people knew about, what did he want? Was it because I've heard you say this before that, you know, you regard yourself as somebody who loves what you do, and that's such a privilege and such a great way to live. And it sounded like he felt the same way about what he did. Would you know what he was trying to do with the Cellar in the first place?
Yeah. Well, to be clear, he didn't take it over. It was always his, you know, from day one. He gave Bill Grunfest a lot of autonomy at the time, although he was always very much involved. It wasn't like Bill was an independent operator, like paying rent or something. They were involved. They would discuss things, you know. My father was very involved, but what's the question again? What did he want to accomplish? What was it?
Was it mostly to make a living, or did he have like a deep belief in, you know, comedy and society? I don't know if you know that background story, but I'd be curious to know what his goals were.
No, he didn't have any deep belief in that stuff. I mean, he never distinguished between making a living and doing what he wanted to do. He had to make a living. So, you know, there were always certain compromises that needed to be made, even within the Comedy Cellar. For instance, doing bringer shows. I don't know if you know what that is. Like a lot of clubs still do it where, you know, you'll do a show where you'll put, you know, kind of amateurs on if they'll bring two or five guests, paying customers to watch them. So when things were very close to the bone, we would have to do things like that, which you know, we don't do them now because we don't have to, and we didn't take any pride in that. It's frowned upon. Frowned upon, maybe exaggerating it, but it's definitely not considered prestigious within the club community. So he was never too proud to do what was necessary to make a living, but he didn't have interest in that. He always tried to make a living doing what he enjoyed, which is that, and that started from his first coffee shop where he'd, you know, play music at the tables. And, you know, also he liked to go out with women and, you know, whatever he wanted to do. Later on, he became a computer programmer and he did recording engineering. He made records with his band. Whatever he wanted to do, he found a way to try to make money from it. So comedy was the same, I guess, and he treated comedy as any other product. He would I was going to say sell, but that sounds vulgar. Like anything else he had is the Dwarman name on, whether it was the, you know, the hummus or the music or the comedy, he had to be able to take pride in it, which sounds like I'm, what's the opposite of elevating? Sounds like I'm diminishing the importance of comedy, but I'm actually elevating the importance of hummus.
And was it always stand up? Did I know that, you know, the Underground now has a small music component to it, or not so small?
No, it was always stand up. And the Underground's not doing music anymore, but we do music once a week in the Olive Tree still with Coleman Hughes and some other people.
Did your dad have, you know, I'd love for the audience to kind of hear, you know, get a picture of what the cellar was like when your dad started it, and who the comedians were, who his favorite comedians were. What do you know about that, you know, beginning time?
Yeah, well, the first generation of comedians there, a lot of them became famous, like Bill Maher, Gilbert Gottfried, Jon Stewart, Ray Romano, although Ray Romano was even like a few years later than those guys. And basically every Larry David, even at the very beginning, and I'm sure Chris Rock. I mean, there's so many of them, and they, you know, they all came through there. They were almost all of them were standout talents almost on day one. But then they got even better and better. You know, it's kind of like imagining seeing the Beatles at the Cavern Club or something. I'm sure they were, you know, awesome. They obviously were awesome, but then they became the Beatles, even more awesome. So that's kind of the trajectory of all the comedians.
And am I right in thinking that at that time, the way to stardom was you had to get your act down, but it was all about getting on the Johnny Carson show or getting on the late night shows to get more, you know, notoriety and attention. Is that about right? Is that how those men specifically rose to the prominence that they did?
Yeah, in those days, the late night shows, I mean, people can't even imagine how different it was then. There were, you know, three major networks. This is even before the Fox network was anything. And then, you know, a couple of local TV channels. And I mean, everything that's now dispersed in a million different directions was funneled through three late night networks, basically. And so it was a huge thing to be able to get on the Johnny Carson show. And if you had a successful appearance on Johnny Carson show, this very often led to sitcoms and movies and, you know, whatever the pot of gold was. So yeah, that was huge. And actually, we were never, this is part of the reason I think we were slow in succeeding. We were never actually a feeder club to those shows. That was more like Catch a Rising Star and the Improv, some clubs that, historic clubs that don't exist today, Comic Strip, which still kind of exists today. I think the first person that ever really launched their career from the cellar was Ray Romano, when he asked the Letterman show to come down to the cellar to see him. And he was instrumental in that. I wonder if he's ever told that story. I should probably get that story from him before, you know, just to have it archived somewhere. But yeah, he was a huge factor for us, and he was very loyal to us and very had a tremendous amount of affection for my father. He even dedicated, after my father died, he dedicated one of the Everyone Loves Raymond episodes to him. And that was the first one that was really fed through the cellar. But yeah, that was the way you hit it right. I mean, that was what the goal was. Get on the Tonight Show.
Do you think your dad had a particular talent for identifying stars? I think I've heard you say this in a prior interview too, that there were just certain people whose talents, Jon Stewart was one that I heard you mention, that from the jump, it was obvious that he was a very, you know, talented comedian. Was there something that you know, your dad and his crew and maybe yourself, you know, looked for back in the day and maybe now, that you think is true about how you can identify someone like that?
Well, I'm, my father and I, especially in music, did prove to be good judges of talent, but I think he would also downplay it in the sense that I don't know what where the essence of truth is. To us, it first of all seems kind of obvious, and second of all, part of it is just having the humility to not substitute your judgment for the judgment of the audience. Now, there are times when he and I, and again, this goes for music as well, would see something in someone which caught our fancy, something interesting about them, something charismatic about them, and that where other people didn't see that, and that we proved to have been correct. But I wouldn't want to overstate that. I think that quite often where these bookers go wrong is that they get enamored with themselves, and they I don't even know what goes through their minds. It's like similar to like dumb politics, but they get enamored with some sort of stupid checklist of things that they think is things that are good or important or not important, things that are classy, not classy, things that are that sophisticated people like and unsophisticated people shouldn't like. I mean, unsophisticated things that sophisticated people like and things that unsophisticated people like, and they want to be on the side of the sophisticates, and they just become so tangled in this web what's the word for it? It's like arrogance and
pretense.
Yeah, pretense is a better word. It's not coming to me, but that they just flop. That's just what it is. They just get so weighed down by all this stuff. They do this flop rather than you go into a room and say, "Oh, the audience is laughing at that guy. Like, who am I to gainsay the collective wisdom of, you know?" And you see it more than once, obviously, of, you know, thousands of people. They think he's funny. Who am I? I'm going to say he's not funny. Like, of course he's funny, right? And you know, I guess you have your limits about something which is hack or completely unoriginal. But you know, when I was, this is an important story. When I was coming up, the comedians all, can I curse?
Of course.
They all shit all over Eddie Murphy. They would all, I mean, I remember seeing Raw and saying, "Oh, I saw Raw. It was fantastic." And they're like, "Ah, he's a hack. He's derivative. He's copying Pryor." Like, you know, they made me feel like 2 inches tall because I thought that Eddie Murphy Raw was funny. And then, you know, fast forward to today, that's the current generation of comedians. They love Eddie Murphy Raw. That's their hero. That's their, some of them went into comedy because they saw that movie. So it was just it's a very clear illustration how the collective wisdom can be totally wrong at a particular time because they've got all this nonsense in their head, you know?
There's a man I see on pictures every time I go to one of the four venues who just in my friend group, and I think on the internet, has had a bit of a resurgence of popularity, who died very young, Patrice O'Neill, who I know, I believe from the interviews I've watched of you, you know, you and especially your dad knew him, and yeah, there was some contention there between himself and your father. I wanted to make sure I gave some space to you to share anything that comes to mind about Patrice, because he just seems to have this resurgence in, I don't know if it's just the online zeitgeist or in culture in general, but I wanted to put that to you to get any stories or, you know, thoughts you have about the man and the relationship that he had with the seller and with your dad.
Well, I mean, nobody ever denied his talent, but he was a very surly, difficult, contrary guy who didn't kind of have more than respect, he had a kind of disdain for the kind of social compact, as it were, of a performer vis-a-vis the audience, meaning that he didn't give a shit if he didn't, you know, about being fun. If he didn't feel like it, he would trash the room, or, and he would almost consider it a badge of honor that somebody walked out or they hated him, or, and, you know, obviously as a club owner having to make your living here, this was, you know, going to age you, because you want customers to be happy. But it goes beyond that. I just, and a lot of comedians still have some of this, but he really had it on a grand scale. He did everything big, which is that I don't respect that. People are coming to pay money to watch you perform. And often they've gone, I mean, it wouldn't matter if it was a impulse decision that decided to walk in, but often they've planned for it and made plans with their friends, and they got babysitters, and, you know, they go for a night on the town and they come to see you perform. And I do not respect the notion that as a performer, you say, it doesn't matter, I'm going to do what I want to do. It's obviously wrong. I don't know why the comedians respect it. If you go to see a concert and the performer says, I don't feel like it, I'm just going to play, you know, whatever, kids songs tonight, you'd say, who does he think he is, you know? But comedians, some of them have some sort of respect for that. And I get it in the sense that they do have to have some freedom to experiment, to push forward, to take risks, so that they happen on insightful and, creative things that they wouldn't have thought of. It's all there. It's all valid in proper proportions. But, you know, the professionals, they try stuff. If it's not working, they go back to their tried and true stuff. They make sure the audience gets their money's worth and the audience leaves happy. And they also service their own needs to try new material or to experiment or be free form or whatever it is. So Patrice, you know, he just didn't see the world that way. And this was, in some ways, I've only heard this. I didn't really know it at the time. Self-destructive to his career, because he would do this kind of stuff on auditions, or, you know, he would alienate. I think there's some story that goes around podcasts about when he had a thing with Spike Lee, and Spike Lee was, I can't take this guy, stuff like that. So, you know, that was Patrice. He was so talented. He had significant success despite being his own worst enemy. But just imagine if he had chosen not to be his worst enemy, and maybe he'd also still be alive. I don't know. But having said all that, I liked him. I had a good relationship with him. He was one time very insulting to my father, personally. But that's, you know, these things happen in that world. That's not really, doesn't define much.
What was his talent? What made him so good?
Patrice was very, very insightful about human nature, about the real unspoken dynamics that were going on, especially between men and women. And he was fearless. You know, he would say them out loud, and he didn't care what anybody thought. And that was his talent. You know, well, I mean, he had certain natural physical talents. He had that big voice. He had this. He was huge. He had this charisma. You didn't see Patrice. You only had to see him once, and you'd never forgot him, right? It's not like one of these comedians, was that the guy? Was that, I'm trying to remember, you know, like he was huge, right? But then he also, as I said, he had a deep intellect and a deep observational eye. And so he's revered for that as well.
I want to get back to the history here. I know you went to Penn for law school.
Yes.
How in the hell did you end up back in the comedy world, taking over your dad's club? What's the transition story? What's the background as to how you got to be in the position you are in the first place here?
So I went to law school. I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. Obviously I was good at it, to go to Penn. And, but then I don't know if people know how it works. Between your second and third year of law school, you become a summer associate. And a summer associate is you get a job with a law firm. I took a job with an entertainment law firm out in Los Angeles. And you do some work for them. And then if they like your work, but they also wine and dine you. If they like your work, they generally make you an offer of employment that would commence after you take the bar, after your third year is finished. So I went out there, and this was a pretty high-end firm. And what I discovered was that they were all miserable. I mean, they were all friggin' miserable. And this particular firm, it had a policy where in your after your seventh year of being a partner, which means you're an associate for 7 years, and if you make partner, so maybe your 15th year of living in that world, you got a year sabbatical with pay to do whatever you want. So after 15 years, you get to take, after 14 years, you get to take a year off. And they were all living for this 15th year. And they were all like, tell me, like, you have to know that you get this year sabbatical. This is why you should come work to our firm. And I had never seen my father, you know, ever not want to go to work. And I remember he always used to say to me, Noam, most people live for the weekend. They hate their jobs. They can't wait for their days off. He says, don't ever be one of those guys. He used to say, that was like a thing growing up. Don't be one of those schmucks who spend their lives hating, you know, 5 out of 7 days. So I realized I was on track to be one of those schmucks who was going to hate 5 out of 7 days. So I told my father this, and he said, well, yeah, but please, you know, will you take the bar? Which I was a sensible chap. I was going to do that anyway. I knew I wasn't going to waste all that time and not take the bar. So I took the bar, I passed the bar, and then I began to play music. And he had the previous club that I told you that had moved, then that club moved. So there was an empty room where the Cafe Wa is now. Now, the Cafe Wa had closed its doors in 1968, but really compacting the story, I took over that room and I started a band, and I renamed it the Cafe Wa. And within like a year and a half, there was lines around the door. And then it became lines around the door 7 nights a week. And I had a long career there, next door to the Comedy Cellar at this place called the Cafe Wa, where I lost my hearing and I played for years. and it was, that was what I did. And then when he died, I had to kind of choose what to do, and I was getting older, and I just decided to throw in with the comedy, because I know I wanted to have a family and things like that, and the musician kind of running a music club lifestyle was not probably a good idea. So that's how it happened.
And I'd love to take the audience to that time period. Am I remembering correctly, it was the early 2000s, and if that's right, what is the scene at the Comedy Cellar at that time? What's the state of comedy? I'd love to give you some time to talk about what you remember about just how things were when you took over the cellar.
Yes, this would be end of 2003. My father died at the end of 2003. So, I mean, the cellar was successful at this point. Jerry Seinfeld had recently shot most of his documentary there. Chris Rock had become famous. Chappelle had become huge. Everybody was coming there at the time. The internet hadn't fully matured yet, so the word wasn't out quite like it got out later. This was prior to Louis C.K. doing his show, which became huge, which really kind of gave us a boost. But when my father died, and Colin Quinn was doing his show, Tough Crowd, which had been his kind of version of what went on at the back table at the Comedy Cellar. But I remember thinking and saying to my father as he was in the hospital before he died that this was our peak. I didn't really see how we could go anywhere but down from where we were. And I was worried about it because I feel, well, Colin's show is going to get canceled and Chappelle's show will eventually fade out. And, you know, we're experiencing this wave. Now, in retrospect, that level of business was nothing compared to the business we have now. We were doing 2 shows on a weekday and only one of them was sold out. Now we do 3 shows and they're all sold out. We have 70 something shows a week in 4 different stages. There we had one stage with probably you know, 15, 18 shows a week. So, I mean, you can't even imagine how, but I remember thinking we couldn't get better than that. But that was the scene. That was the scene. And then it just kept growing. It just kept growing.
What is your explanation as to why it has kept growing for so many years? What do you, I'm sure you think about this and have talked, you know, to your business partners and your family about this. How do you make sense of why a small comedy venue with 120 people crammed in there is a ticket that's nearly impossible to get in New York? And obviously you have multiple clubs, but what do you make of that?
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's definitely the product of a lot of good decisions, and it's also a product of the cultural trends that, you know, I can't take credit for. So if you have a, you know, sold out folk music club that puts all the other folk music clubs to shame, you're running things very, very well. On the other hand, you can't take credit for the fact that folk music happens to become very popular at a particular time in the culture. Right now, comedy is very, very popular. Comedians are selling out Madison Square Garden. I mean, we've never seen comedians so popular, right? So we benefit from that. On the other hand, we are much, much busier than the other places. We're lower priced. I think we have better shows, and I think we have better atmosphere, and I think we sweat the details of each customer's kind of satisfaction in a way that I don't even think the other clubs concern themselves with such things, to be honest. Like, I spend my morning every day answering customer emails. We send out emails to every customer immediately after the show, like 30 minutes after they walk out the door, they get an email. How was everything? Was this good? Was that bad? And I follow up. If I get an email from a customer that their Coke was flat or the ice was melted in their drink, I spend my morning following up on that. Who was the waitress? Why did it happen? How, you know, trying to make sure it doesn't happen again. Refunding the customer, whatever it takes. So this stuff adds up. And by the way, Amazon operates the same way. I don't know if you ever had any experience with Amazon customer service or whatever it is. They'll do anything for you. And so I that can't be irrelevant to the Amazon success.
I've heard you talk about the design of the venues as well, and how you want to make it a little bit more crowded in there than might be comfortable. And that a lot of the design, which is something just as a longtime customer, I'd never really considered until I heard you say it. There's a lot of thought that goes into how the experience is structured. And there's almost nowhere like it in society anymore where no one is on their phone. Everyone is scrunched together and you're watching a person with a microphone talking. I'd love to give you some space to talk about the thought that goes into just the design of the experience in there for the customers and how you think that may have helped the growth of the seller and why you think it works.
Yeah, well, this may be something that my father and I have. Maybe it's probably genetic in some way that he could too. Just sit in a room and feel when it was right or not right, and it's the product of so many little details: the right level, the lighting, the height of the stage. You want to be seated. And feel claustrophobic. You don't want to see empty spaces. The colors, the building materials, it all adds up. This stuff is all important. I don't think the other clubs. I mean, I've been to some other clubs that I thought were pretty good. I still haven't been out to Rogan's Club in Austin. I've heard that it's good. I've been to the Comedy Store in LA. It's pretty good. But people love the Cellar. And the phone thing that you mentioned, this is interesting to me because when Chappelle started doing shows and demanding that everybody use these Yonder bags, I don't know if you know what this is.
Sure.
I got worried that this was going to be something which he was going to want, and that if he wanted it, it would filter down and become the standard. But the worry was that the yonder bags are actually very time consuming. You have to pouch them and then unpouch them, and then you have to get a personnel to do it, which of course it's expensive to get the personnel to do it, but more importantly, it would take so long that we would actually lose probably an entire show a night because it would push the show so late. So I kind of went into a panic about it, and we started brainstorming about what we could do to get these phones bagged in a way which would do the job. And then this guy who works for me, Tony, is a Mexican guy who's worked me for 30 years. He was actually the one who came up with the idea. We were all talking about it, trying to figure it out. And Amazon, or the postman, comes with an Amazon delivery, and it has one of these Amazon, I don't know if I have one around here, but you know, the Amazon pouches, you know. And he says, "What about the pouches?" I'm like, "Yeah, that's perfect, because that way they're very cheap. And you can just give it, the customer puts it in, and we're in a small room. It's not like Madison Square Garden. You can't really take it out inconspicuously. And that way, if they do need to use a phone, they can just go outside. They can rip open their own phone, and we give them another envelope, right? Now, it's a little time consuming. It's a hassle to get everybody's phone into the bags, but this worked great. So we bag every phone, and I was sure, this is what I'm getting to, I'm being too wordy. I was sure that every club would start doing what we're doing, because it's not very expensive. And clearly, unanimously, every comedian says this improved the shows. And yet, not another show, not another club has done it. Not another club has emulated us, which to me is just a huge illustration that somehow they don't see things like I do. Like, there's just some disconnect. I know that if Gotham Comedy Club had started bagging their phones and I heard that the comedians like this better, I would have started the next day. Like, there was just no way I would have been caught out there like that. So that's the difference.
Yeah. I've done multiple shows on this podcast about free speech, freedom of speech. And I know you've done both on your own show and on other podcast platforms. You've talked at length about freedom of speech. I want to read a couple quotes that I wrote down from you in preparation for this interview. And then I want to get your thoughts on the state of free speech and its relation to comedy now.
Okay.
This is one from you. Quote, "The issues that are off limits highly correlate to issues that have strong arguments that people are being prevented from presenting." And then another quote is, quote, we have to start stigmatizing people who are offended. Thick skin has to be what we expect from people. You also made this offhanded comment once, which I thought was very insightful, about how, freedom of speech has always been important to me as well. But that in the 60s, the causes that the left cared about, primarily civil rights and Vietnam, required freedom of speech to make progress on. And this is a long way of me just opening up some space for us to talk about freedom of speech and your views on its importance. I don't know if you see a correlation between the rise in the popularity of comedy and comedy venues and more of woke culture over the last 5 years or so, but I'd love to give you space to start a conversation about freedom of speech as a topic, how you think about it, and why you think it matters.
Well, I mean, it matters for the reasons that you've said. It's everything. But I mean, you said so much. I'm just trying to think about it. I think that we were all suffocating under this kind of cloud of being afraid what we could say and what we couldn't say. I think this is a big part of the reason that Trump won. I don't see how anybody can deny that at this point. We just got sick and tired of these scolds, I was going to say rolling their eyes, but it was much more than rolling their eyes, trying to ruin us because people were saying things that they didn't like. And obviously, you know, the examples are cliche, like Galileo, but you can go through every period in history where somebody was saying something unpopular, and that unpopular opinion eventually became the accepted opinion. And it was so deep in our culture, it was so deep in the culture of the left for so long to respect people's right to say things. And they had shows like Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher, which was a left-wing show where it kind of marketed by you're going to say things you're not supposed to say. And then somehow it all changed. It changed in some way with the enforcement mechanism that social media allowed and provided to, I think, what was always a relatively small group of people in the end. I mean, I know when I took some heat on Twitter, if 15 or 20 people tweeted about me, I felt like the whole world was coming down on me. And apparently NBC was no different, right? When Shane Gillis made some Asian joke, some Asian accent. I mean, this is nothing in the scheme of things, right? On a small podcast. I mean, it's nothing unless you think Shane Gillis actually hates Asian people, which is absurd, right? It's just absurd. And by the way, just, you know, you can stop me, but just as to digress, I've been in the room quite often when a comedian will do an Asian accent, and sometimes like really over the top, you know, and I go like, oh God. And I start watching carefully the Asian people in the audience, and they laugh. They're not actually offended. The white people will get very, very, very nervous, like, you know, and they'll look at the, take their signals from the Asian people. But for the most part, most people are not nuts. You know, they can understand the difference between, I mean, accents do exist, right? It's not like accents don't exist. Everybody knows accents exist. And imitating one is not prima facie case of hatefulness. Anyway, but NBC, you know, Shane Gillis did some Asian thing and they fired him because of some, probably some little thing, little blister that popped, that bubbled up on social media. So social media was scaring the shit out of everybody. This was the enforcement mechanism, and it emboldened people. Wokeness on top of that is just a sick, disgusting ideology at this point. And I just always knew in my gut that I had to oppose that. I threw in defending Louis, which was not just simply a free speech issue. It was also I was also striking a blow for the notion that that the presumptions of innocence were important, that free association was important, meaning that if the customers wanted to see him and I wanted to present him, and it was a closed community here of people who want to see Louis C.K., who's not been convicted or even charged with any crime, that is none of the business of the greater society. No more than I think it's my business if somebody wants to go see a Nazi. Like, I've never thought that was my business, right? So, not that I'm calling Louis C.K. a Nazi. So I was striking a blow for all those things. And really, boy, was I vindicated, you know, like on every one of these things. And sure enough, the ad hoc nature of the outrage and believing all women and all this stuff has just been, you know, it's just absurd at this point, where Kamala Harris's husband had three witnesses say he hit a woman so hard in the face that she spun around. Nobody cared. He goes to every Washington banquet and Hollywood banquet, right? So it's just really illustrated to me, this is just this total nonsense and hypocrisy. Kamala Harris's husband was accused of doing much worse than anything Louis C.K. was ever accused of, and nobody cared. Nobody cared. So, but I always sensed that.
How do you make sense of that change on the left? I mean, I'm old enough to remember that, and that being one of the big reasons why I always considered myself someone of the left was because they were the people granting rights and freedom of speech and freedom of association to even extreme hateful minorities like neo-Nazis out of principle. How do you make sense of that change? Is it really as simple as social media mobs and companies being afraid of being shamed online? Where do you come down on the root cause there?
I think that certain logics have a way of there's a momentum. Nothing ever stays the same, and somehow the logic of intersectionality and my truth, and listen, I'm no expert on this. Yasha Monk wrote a whole book about this, but somehow a certain small logic of seeing oppression just began to spread like ink. You know, you see ink spread. It just began to spread its ink into every aspect of our lives where it could be applied, and almost as if the logic forced you to apply it, to the point where, well, if we care about this oppression, why not this oppression? Why not this way? Well, you know what? People who actually aren't handicapped in any way, they're, you know, and you know, like, where does it stop? And there's 72 genders, and you know, and so now you have to not assume that anybody has a pronoun. You shouldn't assume anybody's a he. Maybe you shouldn't assume that anybody has five fingers, because some people might have six fingers. And, you know, it just became absurd. And that's how it spread. And then, you know, as I said, it got this enforcement mechanism. And of course, the elites and the overeducated are the dumbest of all. And probably, I mean, I know this is another thing I'm sure people study, but there's probably a certain type of high. I do not think that people, professors, have a higher IQ than many other groups of people. They do have a high IQ, but it's a high IQ plus a certain kind of personality, which, like, I don't think they're any smarter than the business people I know. But the business people I know would never go for that stuff. So they have this captive audience of our kids, and they feed them this stuff, and they churn out brainwashed. Maybe that's overstating it, but in some way, brainwashed kids who see the world this way, and it was bad. It was bad. But I think the pendulum is already heavily swinging in the other direction now.
Yeah.
I think it's why Trump won in 2016, by the way. It was already on the radar then.
Yeah. I, just as a fan of what you've created at your venues, I want to ask you if you tend to come down on this conclusion as well, if you have concluded this too. Walking into the Comedy Cellar or the Village Underground felt like it was a bit of the resistance. Like it was the one place left where in real life you could hear satire of unbelievable cancel culture activity happening in the world. And there was something sacred to me about that capacity, that ability to walk in there and hear these brilliant, insightful, hilarious comedians just take to task what the reality of what was happening in academia and online. I'm sure you've thought a lot about this. Did that make you even more committed to the work that you do?
No, I never saw it that way, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I'm happy you saw it that way. I imagine other comedy clubs were similar. No, I never saw it that way. I always just did what I thought was right. And not that I wouldn't have compromised if I had to. I have to make a living. I have a family. I'm not going to die for it. But I wouldn't compromise what I believed in without, you know, really failing at it. And so I just stuck by what I thought was the right way to operate, and it worked, you know. And what I did note early on is that while, my goodness, it was a period with the height of this whole nonsense with Louis, where there were horrible things being written about me in basically every publication, you know? And I said, oh God, this is it. You know, our business is just going to, and we never saw any effect on business whatsoever. So as you probably heard me compare it to, I was like the Wizard of Oz, like pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. And I began to see social media as the face of the Wizard of Oz, but in all the media stuff, like the Huffington Post and Slate and, you know, the Daily Coast and all these ultra left wing public, but even CNN, and it was everywhere. That they didn't represent anything. It was just a balloon, and you could pop it, and it had no real sway or purchase with the everyday customer who were happy to come to the club. And every once in a while, somebody get upset about Louis and they walk out. But so what?
I know you talked about wokeness earlier, and I heard you talk about a story in relation to your daughter. Coming back from school one day, that I would love for you to share if you're comfortable. And maybe before that, I would love for you to define wokeness in your mind of what that means. And then if you're comfortable, I'd love to share your anecdote, because I think it's very descriptive of the situation I think a lot of people have found themselves in.
Yeah, well, wokeness is difficult to define. You know, it's like porn. It's hard to define. But you know, when you see it, no, I mean, but it's some extreme level of coupling of this kind of left wing worldview, which definitely has to include intersectionality and a hyper concern for offense, you know, and oppression novel subliminal forms of oppression that you can't actually define, but we have to respect other people's truths about it, and certain words and cultural appropriation, and all in one direction. So part of it also has this kind of hierarchy where essentially, you know, like you shouldn't, you Mr. Asian person, you shouldn't open a soul food restaurant or wear a dashiki, but you black women, you can buy straight hair. You know, like it's just crazy. Rather than saying, oh, isn't it nice to see in America everybody picking things of other people's cultures that they enjoy and actually wanting to incorporate it into their own culture. And you know, the melting pot actually at one point was considered a sign of white supremacy. So it's that, all that, plus, well, I guess this would make it cancel culture, plus the notion that people, there should be accountability. And it's not just enough to say, you know, I don't agree with that person's view on that, right? I think that person's a jackass. That there should be some sense of the mob, however it can exert itself, disciplining this person. And that's where it really crossed the line. So what happened with my daughter was that she was in second grade. Now, of course, my wife is of color, as they say. I want to gag on it, because when we got married and we first started going out, I mean, I always knew she was Indian and Puerto Rican, but it just didn't have the same priority in people's minds that it does now. And my daughter, I'd say she appears white. And but of course, all our friends are very mixed, and she grew up around black people and Puerto Rican people and even trans people. I don't think she ever really thought about it. But anyway, she comes home from the second grade and she says, I can remember, she said, Dad, you're white, right? I'm like, yes. It's the first time we'd ever discussed. She says, do you treat people badly? I'm like, no. Did you ever see Daddy treat anybody badly? She says, well, we learned that, well, maybe you used to treat people badly. Did you used to treat people badly? So, of course, I was furious at this, because this was just like some second grade teacher, for her own purposes, to show off in some way, inculcating my daughter with a bunch of nonsense about race at an age when she's too young to understand it, when she still believes in Santa Claus, when the teacher is probably so dumb, she actually believes in notions of collective guilt, which is exactly the opposite of what I want my children to think of. So anyway, I was furious. And of course, I didn't dare go to the school and complain about it, because at that time, I was afraid somebody would, you know, videotape me at a school board meeting or something and tweet it out, and then I'd be a villain. So I let it go. But it was such a perfect illustration of what was going on. But then what I did do was I decided to read my children. My youngest wasn't born yet. My daughter was in second grade, and my son was in kindergarten at the time. But he's a very, very precocious kid. And I read them To Kill a Mockingbird. I said, I'm going to deal with this race thing because it's such a good book. And I thought they would get it, and they did. So I read them To Kill a Mockingbird. They were both taken with this book, and they both got a lot out of it. I didn't have to lecture them about race. But then I talked about it on a podcast, and I was reading my kids To Kill a Mockingbird. And then, of course, some left-wing person dinged me for reading my kids To Kill a Mockingbird. They wrote a whole column about – I can't even remember what the argument was about why I shouldn't be doing that. But it's how crazy things got, you know. And they remember that book to this day. I'm very proud of reading it to them. And I'll say the book has the N-word in it, and I did not read them the N-word, which I don't know. My main reason for not reading it to them was that I just didn't want to take the chance they might repeat it. You know, if kids hear something naughty, you know, they might want to repeat it. But I also had to admit that I was in some way just it had gotten into me in a Pavlovian kind of way that you just shouldn't read this word, even if you're quoting it. And it bothers me because I don't believe that at all. I think that's ridiculous. I think it's literature. Of course, I should be able to read the word as a reality of its time, right? Just like I could describe the concentration camps. That's awful also. But I didn't. And even to this day, I don't know if I would. But anyway, that's just an interesting aside.
Given that story, I have to imagine I understand the infuriation you must have felt as a dad. Do you think, and you may have already answered this earlier in the conversation, that we are on the other side of this, that the cancel culture phenomenon, wokeness in general, the pendulum really is swinging? Where do you see this going, maybe in relation to comedy specifically, but socially in America in general?
Yeah, it's definitely swung. Well, you know, it's swung to some extent away from wokeness. People calling me, but it's also been exposed to some extent that the pendulum was never where we thought it was. And this, you know, this is actually important to think about, that it wasn't simply that the pendulum was far left and it's swinging more to the center. It's that the actual polled center, if you could poll it, the polled pendulum was always pretty close to the center. We were just intimidated by this, as I said, the Wizard of Oz appearance, that there was so much support for people on the left. And there were polls over the last 6-7 years that talk about how like 70% of people are afraid of saying the wrong thing. And the people did not like this. And I used to have left-wing people on my podcast who, as soon as the show ended, they'd be like, the mics are off now, right? And then they would answer, a question honestly that they had not been honest with me about, or they had been, you know, careful and guarded and cagey about answering on the show because they were so afraid of saying the wrong thing. I remember, again, with the Louis thing, people would come in, I'd say, what do you think about this Louis C.K. thing? And it'd be like, what do you think about the Louis C.K. thing? They're afraid to say it. And when I would have people interviewed at that time, guests would tell me, I'll come on the podcast, you cannot ask me about Louis. That's like, you can't ask me about it. Because why couldn't I ask about it? Because not because they wanted to say like the party line thing that they knew wouldn't get them in trouble, because overwhelmingly their personal opinion was what they knew would get them in trouble. But they were afraid to say it out loud. Now they're not. They're less afraid to say it out loud now.
I think maybe what you are hitting on is the need, or I certainly have this admiration for certain figures publicly for courage in that kind of an environment, in that kind of a setting. And I'm not sure I've ever heard you answer this question, but who in your mind are those people that, you know, maybe in the last 10 years that they would give you a direct answer, whether that was publicly or privately, they were the same person. Who do you look to, if there are any figures that come to mind, as, you know, both as comedians, as just as writers or thinkers or speakers that you really respect and admire?
Well, I'll tell you who has courage. Now, the courage is not necessarily an endorsement of their views. Like Chappelle, this guy does not care. He says what he thinks, you know, and I admire that. He says some things about Israel that I wish he wouldn't say, you know, because I don't agree with them. But I, you know, that's up to him to say. But he's courageous. Andrew Schultz has been courageous. Now, at the same time, these people ended up cultivating huge audiences because there was a huge market for this, people being courageous. As a matter of fact, most of the most successful podcasts out there in some way are people saying stuff which, or giving a forum to people saying stuff which could be considered in some way courageous. Now, some of this is a problem to me. Some of this is very conspiratorial, and I don't respect it, actually. And something is going wrong with the fact that, I don't know if it's algorithmic, I don't know why people like, you know, Candace Owens, who's saying, you know, she's saying stuff that's so outlandish, I think it's beyond what reasonable people could disagree about. Like, just crazy conspiratorial nonsense. And she has millions and millions of followers. I don't know why that is. That's a bad thing, but you know, certainly wouldn't take away her right to say it. Who do you think has been courageous?
Well, one of my favorites is someone I know you know, who I've followed. He's still so young, but Coleman Hughes to me has been somebody who has been.
Oh yeah, I thought you meant comedians. Yeah, he's, you know, he and I are very close friends. He's very courageous, very, very courageous.
Yeah. I think to me, it's a combination of courage with a reasonable take on what is going on. I think that may be what you're alluding to there, is it's aligned with truth. It's not provocative just to be provocative.
Right.
It's an attempt to tell people what's really happening.
Well, he holds himself to a certain, you know, objective academic standards of what he'll say and what he won't say. You know, and Barry Weiss was very courageous. A lot of these people landed on their feet. And because they landed on their feet, people can underestimate the risks that these people took at the time.
Yeah.
But when she left the New York Times, when she wrote that pointed resignation letter, she had no idea that she was going to fall on her feet. She just wasn't going to compromise. And that was courageous. And, you know, like I said, it's very important to remember what the situation was at the time that people did this stuff, not the fact that it all worked out.
Fair. Noam, I know we're getting close to the end of our time together. And I want to just say again, what an honor this has been to get to talk to you a little bit. And maybe we can close with just what's next for you. What's getting you excited? What's on your mind? I think I heard you say there might be a new venue opening up at the Comedy Cellar venue. What's up? What's going on in the future and getting you excited?
Yeah, well, in April of 2023, we bought a building around the corner where the McDonald's used to be on 6th Avenue across from the Blue Note, 6th Avenue, I'm sorry, on 3rd Street and 6th Avenue. And but my God, it's just so much regulation and red tape in New York City. We're 19 months into, and we still haven't been able to drive a nail into the wall. But hopefully the clouds are clearing on that one. So that's our new project, is a new comedy club. Hopefully the nicest of all the Comedy Cellars. That remains to be seen. You know, things don't always work out as you intend. So that's the project for the next year to year and a half. And then I focus on my family now. I have three kids all growing up. And that really takes up most of my attention. So between the new club and the kids, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, fair. Well, thank you so much for your time today, man. It was great to meet you.
My pleasure. And let me know when you're coming down to the club and get a drink or something.
That'd be great.